And while Behrman admitted that he might be, as the Times Democrat called him, somewhat uncouth, he at least knew what the common people of New Orleans wanted. Virtually all of the city's newspapers had opposed the election of such an unpolished machine politician. "Mr. Behrman does not rise to the standards of public office," the Times Democrat wrote during the campaign, "but represents the very elements that would assure misgovernment of the city and seriously hinder and check its prosperity." But Behrman's most vociferous detractor was none other than W.S. Parkerson, the blue-blooded paragon who had led the parish prison lynching back in 1891. Still active in reform politics, Parkerson accused Behrman of all kinds of malfeasance, including grafting for the Edison Electric Company and making illegal use of a railroad pass. The campaign turned out to be one of the bitterest in recent memory. "I would rather be a maggot in the superating carcass of an insane mule than be that man Parkerson," one Behrman operative announced at a rally. But Behrman ultimately emerged triumphant, and in this new mayor, Storyville and its people could not have found a better friend. Meanwhile, the district was maturing, so to speak, into a full-fledged subculture, as colorful as it was profitable. A list of the neighborhood's extensive cast of characters, including prostitutes, pimps, gamblers, and various hustlers, would include such names as Steel Arm Johnny, Merry Meathouse, Gold Tooth Gussie, Bird Leg Nora, Titanic, Coke-Eyed Laura, Scratch, Bullfrog Sunny, Snaggle Moof Mary, Stack O'Dollars, Charlie Bow Wow, Good Lord the Lifter, and many more. The exploits of most of these notorious individuals have been lost to history, though a few, like Boxcar Shorty and Boar Hog, were later immortalized in the lyrics of jazz recordings. And although some historians claim that the rate of violent crime was actually relatively low in Storyville, at least by the standards of New Orleans as a whole, which from 1900 to 1910 had a per capita murder rate three times that of Chicago, this was hardly a peaceable bunch of men and women. According to Jelly Roll Morton, one Storyville tough by the name of Aaron Harris, "no doubt the most heartless man I've ever heard of or seen," had no fewer than 11 murders to his credit. Even some of the Basin Street madams were known for their readiness to resort to guns or knives to settle their disputes. In 1904, Lulu White was arrested on a weapons charge after firing two shots at her white lover, George Lambert, who apparently had left her for another woman. Unable to contain her jealousy, White had gone to her lover's home to confront him as he was playing poker with some friends. According to the Daily Picayune, "Lulu dashed into the room where the poker players were. Seeing Lambert, she began abusing him and fired two shots at him." The shots missed, as perhaps they were intended to, and one of the other poker players pulled the pistol from her hand before she could fire again. White ultimately was charged, but with nothing more than carrying a concealed weapon, a crime that in New Orleans rarely led to any serious consequences. Such colorful episodes were relatively harmless and easy to dismiss, but there were increasing signs in recent years that the debauched goings-on in Storyville might be getting too outré for even the most open-minded New Orleanians. Of course, some of the wilder stories told about the district are surely more folklore than history. The fact that they were told at all, however, indicates a growing disgust in the city at large regarding the monster that had been created some 10 years before. One story held that Lulu White began offering her customers a discount book of 15 tickets, each depicting a different lewd act, said act to be provided to the bearer simply upon presentation of the ticket. And there were other, more lurid tales of deflowering auctions, mother-daughter harlot teams, erotic animal acts, and one so-called dancer, Olivia the Oyster Queen, who allegedly could shimmy a shelled, glistening bivalve over her entire naked body without ever touching it with her hands. Many of these reports centered on one brothel, Emma Johnson's House of All Nations at 331 Basin Street. Johnson herself, described as a tall, rangy, and very masculine Cajun lesbian, was getting on in years by the first decade of the 20th century, but her house offered some of the youngest, the very youngest, prostitutes in the district. They purportedly gave nightly sex circuses in which every form of fetishism, voyeurism, and sadomasochism was engaged in.
"They did a lot of things that probably couldn't be mentioned,"
right before the eyes of everybody, reported Jelly Roll Morton, who often played piano at Johnson's house. A screen was put up between me and the tricks they were doing for the guests, but I cut a slit in the screen, as I had come to be a sport now myself, and wanted to see what everybody else was seeing. But Morton's breezy knowingness aside, this was where the Storyville pretense of harmless racy fun showed its depraved underbelly. To most sensibilities of the day, pedophilia, bestiality, and sodomy were outrages that even isolation in a restricted district could not make tolerable. Certainly the district's excesses were becoming increasingly intolerable to Josie Arlington. Although she was by all reports making prodigious amounts of money at her palace on Basin Street, she still could not get past her persistent discomfort with her life and her growing desperation to keep that knowledge from her adored niece, Anna. According to one friend, Arlington was in dread fear continually that this girl would find out who she was. In 1903, faced with the quandary that Anna would soon be returning home from convent school in Paris, Arlington used some of her brothel profits to buy a house in Covington, Louisiana, safely away from New Orleans, near Abita Springs, on the other side of Lake Pontchartrain. She named the place Anna's Villa, and when the girl returned from Europe in July of 1904, she was sent directly there to spend the summer. Arlington then enrolled the girl in another convent school, this one in Clifton, Ohio, where she could be sheltered for another 2 years. But this could only be a stopgap measure. After those 2 years, Anna would be finished with her schooling, and she would want to come home to her family in New Orleans. Then, on the morning of December 1st, 1905, some workmen painting the Arlington brothel's top floor accidentally set fire to the building. It was 11 a.m., and the residents of the place were all still asleep, but they were quickly roused and evacuated. According to the Daily Picayune, the panicky women ran down Basin Street carrying bedsheets stuffed with whatever possessions they could grab. They then assembled, scantily clad, in the saloon of Tom Anderson's annex. Fortunately, the brothel fire burned slowly, and had only destroyed the attic and two upper floors before it was put out. But although the place was adequately insured, Josie Arlington had lost many of the beautiful paintings and furniture she had bought when traveling in Europe. A reporter for the Picayune took the opportunity to engage in a bit of sermonizing. He described the overdramatic women weeping and moaning, some of them more for the purpose of exciting sympathy and attention than for any actual loss. But then he saw one woman, legitimately grief-stricken, crying in a hallway. When asked why she was so upset, she said that, in the excitement of her escape, she had forgotten to rescue a picture of her mother. It was this loss that caused the young woman such pain. "Surely there was some good left in the heart of the little woman," the reporter oozed, "who, amidst the vices by which she was surrounded, and in her degradation, yet remembered her mother, valuing the picture far above all the diamonds, jewels, and fine dresses which she was possessed of." This scene from Victorian melodrama notwithstanding, Arlington and her employees were unwilling to be out of business for long, so, while the house at 225 Basin Street was being repaired, they set up shop in the upper rooms of Anderson's annex, which henceforth became known as the Arlington Annex. But while the brothel's proprietress had come through the fire physically and financially unscathed, the close call only reinforced her conviction to somehow live a more respectable kind of life. According to some reports, after the fire she began to speak gloomily to her prostitutes of the fire and brimstone that awaited all sinners after death, and her desire to keep Anna free of the taint of Storyville just grew stronger. By 1906, she had become prosperous enough to pull off this feat. In that year, Arlington purchased an imposing white mansion on Esplanade Avenue, in an ultra-respectable part of town out toward the city park. This, she decided, was where she would undertake to live her second life of sober propriety. Until this point, she and Tom Brady had lived separately, she in the brothel and he in his mother's house, though they did also have a room at the home of Arlington's cousin where they could rendezvous whenever necessary. This was her choice, not his. Brady had actually asked her to marry him several years earlier, but she'd refused. According to Brady, she told him that since they'd gone along this far without doing the deed, they might as well go along as they were for the balance. But now they would live together as ostensible man and wife for all the world to see. Josie arranged for her brother Henry Dubler's family, including his wife and three sons, Anna's brothers, to move in with them, and of course Anna herself would join them after leaving school. In preparation, Arlington instructed everyone they knew, everyone that her niece might have any contact with, to start addressing her not as Josie or Miss Arlington or even as Mary Dubler, but as Mrs. Brady. If the masquerade was to work, there could be no mistakes. And so the Dublers and the Bradys lived the life of a normal extended family in the large house on Esplanade. Arlington put more and more of the responsibility for running the brothel on one of her surrogates, but she still enjoyed the revenue stream that made her new life possible. Some of her more presentable Storyville associates, including Tom Anderson, would occasionally be invited to family dinners and birthday parties, at the house or at Anna's villa. But Anna, who apparently was not a careful reader of the New Orleans newspapers, never suspected that these people were anything other than upstanding friends of her Aunt Mary and Uncle Tom. The young woman would in fact live for years in the house on Esplanade in blissful ignorance of the source of her family's prosperity on Basin Street, just a few short miles away. But others in New Orleans did not have the luxury of being so insulated from the spectacle of Storyville. Local business reformers may still have been satisfied with the results of their 1898 experiment, but moral reformers, emboldened by the rise of organizations like the Anti-Saloon League and the Social Hygiene Movement, were becoming increasingly vocal in their opposition to the goings-on in the city's Tenderloin. Drawing boundaries around sin had clearly not worked, and the impulse toward outright prohibition of prostitution, alcohol, gambling, and other vices was gaining ground all over the nation in the first decade of the 20th century. In the Louisiana State Legislature, support was growing, despite Representative Thomas C. Anderson's strenuous efforts, for stronger legislative measures to put the lid on sin. Already in 1904, they had passed a law to close the state's pool rooms. Another proposed measure would prohibit horse track betting throughout the state. And now, as the 1908 elections approached, there was talk of an even more comprehensive anti-vice law, one that would totally revamp the way alcohol could be sold in Louisiana, at the same time placing onerous new restrictions on the ability of women and blacks to work in and patronize the establishments that served it. For the members of New Orleans' demimonde, the madams, pimps, saloon and dance hall proprietors, and the prostitutes and musicians they employed, there were to be some tough times ahead. In its first 10 years of existence, the city's segregated vice districts on both sides of Canal Street had largely been left alone, and they had thrived, far too well for the comfort of many. But now there were to be some changes in New Orleans. The city's self-styled champions of virtue and purity were finally ready to strike back. Part 3. Battlegrounds of Sin, 1907 to 1917. Chapter 11. The Black Hand. On a warm June evening in 1907, a small, fair-haired boy named Walter LaManna was playing outside his father's undertaking business on St. Philip Street in the French Quarter. The boy was alone, amusing himself quietly in the alley beside the building. It was nearly 8 p.m., and the amber evening light was waning, the time of day when the quarter's characteristic smells of garlic and horse dung and sweetly rotting fruit seemed momentarily to intensify in the dusk. As Walter played under the arches, one of the establishment's horse-drawn hearses, returning from a late Saturday funeral, turned into the alley. The driver stopped and said a few words to the boy. Then he continued down the alley to the courtyard beyond, where he busied himself unhitching the wagon and settling the horses into their stables for the night. After a few minutes, another man, in his early 40s, with sparse graying hair and a small mustache, approached Walter in the alley. Exactly what he said to the 8-year-old boy is unknown, but he produced 2 nickels from his pocket and offered to treat the boy to ice cream from a candy store down the street. Walter apparently saw nothing amiss in the offer. He got up from the pavement, took the man's offered hand, and walked with him up St. Philip Street toward the store. When they reached Bourbon Street, they came upon a covered wagon stopped at the corner. A tall man stood beside the wagon, as if waiting for them. This man took Walter's hand, and then, before the boy could protest, lifted him up to the driver, who quickly pushed Walter into the covered space behind him. The tall man then climbed into the back of the wagon and pulled the tarp closed after him. The driver spurred the horse, and the wagon began moving noisily down the poorly paved street. The first man remained standing on the banquet, watching them go in the faltering light. Then he turned away and disappeared into the warren of tenements, outbuildings, taverns, and warehouses of the Lower French Quarter. When Walter did not come back into the family's living quarters after nightfall, his parents were at first unconcerned. The boy often liked to hide in various places around the courtyard, hayloft, and livery stables. Sometimes he'd even fall asleep in his hiding place. But as the evening wore on, the Lamanas became worried. Peter Lamanna, Walter's father, searched the premises and the surrounding neighborhood, but the boy was nowhere to be found. Finally, it occurred to the father that Walter might have stowed away on the tally-ho his older brother John had driven that evening to West End, the lakeside resort some 6 or 7 miles from the city. Lamanna had one of his horses saddled up and rode out to the resort in the moonlight. But when he returned, hours later, he had nothing to report. John had not seen his younger brother. For the rest of that night and throughout the day, on Sunday, Peter Lamanna searched the French Quarter for his son, enlisting friends, employees, and neighborhood children in the hunt. They talked to neighbors, shopkeepers, and anyone else they encountered, but no one seemed to have any idea what had happened to the boy. By Sunday evening, Lamanna decided to go to the police. That he had waited even this long to report the disappearance was not unusual. Members of the city's Italian community typically preferred to deal with their own problems. Besides, the police did not always respond energetically to cases involving Italians, since investigations of crimes in Italian neighborhoods were often met with a wall of mistrustful silence. But Peter Lamanna's case was an exception, as the owner of a prosperous undertaking business and the largest livery stable in the Vieux-Carré, and as a member of the city's powerful Progressive Union, a civic organization composed of the most prominent local businessmen, he was considered a very important man, worthy of the best efforts of the police. And so they responded to the report with a greater determination than they would have if the missing boy had been the son of a downtown grocer or banana handler. The search was expanded to the riverfront, the lakeside district, and throughout the sewers, dark alleys, backyards, and hidden courtyards of the quarter. But then, on Monday morning, an anonymous letter was delivered to the Lamanna residence. Written in Italian in a crude, barely legible hand, it read, "Your boy is comfortably housed, clothed, and fed. He is well, and no harm will be done him, but we will not be responsible for the consequences should you fail to comply with our demands." What followed was a demand for a ransom of $6,000, a huge sum in 1907 dollars, to be delivered by Lamanna himself. According to the instructions in the note, which Lamanna kept secret from everyone except the police, the undertaker was to raise the money in gold and then take it, alone, on horseback, out along the road toward Bogalusa, a small town about 70 miles north of the city. Somewhere on the way, he would be approached by a person who would accept the money from him and tell him where his boy could be found. Unless he wanted Walter sent back to him cut up in pieces, Lamanna was to follow these instructions to the letter. The note was signed with a small skull and crossbones at the bottom. A sure indication, it was said, that it came from the organization known to all Italians as the Black Hand. For more than a decade following the Orleans Parish prison lynching of 1891, New Orleans' Italian underworld had been relatively quiet. "Some 12 years ago, we discovered our mistake in tolerating the vendetta here," the Times Democrat observed in 1902. "But we were aroused from our mistake by a shock of thunder that shook the whole city and indeed the whole Union." That shock, the assassination of David Hennessy, had of course been met with corrective, violent action by many of the city's leading citizens. "The lesson then given was salutary," the paper continued, "and for 12 years New Orleans was almost free from the vendetta. The general peace and order of the community were better because of it, and the Sicilians themselves secured the best results from the improvement." Whether the Sicilians themselves would have agreed with this assessment is perhaps doubtful, but the fact remains that the city had been more or less free of assassination-style murders for the rest of the 1890s. That changed in 1902, however, with the arrival in New Orleans of a man calling himself Francesco Genova. Under his real name, Francesco Mattesi, He had allegedly fled his native Sicily after being indicted for the slaughter of an entire family named Saina. Coming to Louisiana by way of London and New York, where he apparently became associated with legendary mafioso Giuseppe Morello, he quickly established himself as a leader in New Orleans' Italian community, which reportedly knew all about his activities in Sicily and was appropriately cowed. Genova and his supposed accomplice in the Saina murders, Paolo Di Cristina, real name Paolo Marchese, attempted to take control of the local pasta-making business. But they met with some resistance. Two brothers who owned a macaroni factory in nearby Donaldsville, Antonio and Salvatore Luciano, refused to stand for Genova's attempts to force them out of business. One day in early May 1902, Salvatore Luciano caught sight of Genova and Di Cristina in a buggy near the Luciano's boarding house on Poydras Street in New Orleans. Thinking that the two men had come to make good on their various threats to harm the brothers, Salvatore ran inside to grab his shotgun, rushed up to the buggy, and fired at Genova. The shot missed, and although Genova and Di Cristina both suffered painful powder burns, police arrived before anything more serious could occur. But the incident set in motion a brutal interfamily mob war that ended up appalling a city that had hoped its Italian crime problems were over. One night, about a month after the original incident, Antonio Luciano was hosting a poker game at the Poydras Street boarding house while Salvatore sat in an adjacent room writing a letter to their mother in Italy. Four men walked in off the street and, without much preamble, fell upon Salvatore Luciano with knives and clubs. Antonio, hearing the disturbance, grabbed his shotgun and started firing. The ensuing melee left Salvatore and one of the poker players dead, and two more men seriously wounded. The next day, after being released from jail under a plea of self-defense, Antonio Luciano was overseeing his brother's wake at the boarding house. Friends of the family were milling around Salvatore's body, which had been laid out on a table in one of the larger rooms. Antonio looked on in amazement as a man named Ferrara, whom he recognized as one of his brother's murderers, stepped up to the corpse, pushed aside the gauzy shroud, and planted a kiss on the dead man's lips. Enraged and incredulous, Antonio beckoned to Ferrara to follow him into the courtyard of the boarding house. Ferrara, apparently unaware that he'd been recognized, complied, and was met with both barrels of a loaded shotgun. Antonio discharged the weapon into Ferrara's chest, and then, while the horrified guests looked on, proceeded to beat the man's head to a pulp with the broken stock of the shotgun. "I am satisfied," Antonio crowed as he was arrested. "I have killed the man who slew my brother." Francesco Genova, on the other hand, was emphatically not satisfied, but he was patient. When Antonio Luciano was again released from jail after a quick acquittal for the killing of Ferrara, Genova sent for a gunman from New York, one Espare, a stranger to New Orleans who befriended Luciano, and, over the next few weeks, slowly earned his trust. One day in August 1902, the genial Espare accompanied his new friend to a photographer's shop on Canal Street to fetch some newly developed photos. After they had retrieved the prints, as they were descending the outdoor stairwell back to Canal Street, Espare calmly took a revolver from his belt and fired six shots into Antonio Luciano's back. Luciano attempted to shoot back, but lost his footing and tumbled down the stairway into the street. Espare raced up to the roof, jumped to the roof of the adjoining building, which happened to be Tom Anderson's Arlington restaurant on Rampart Street, and disappeared into the open skylight. Fortunately for the cause of New Orleans justice, the fatal shooting had been witnessed by several members of the city's exclusive Pickwick Club, which stood just across Canal Street from the photographer's shop. When Espare was brought up on murder charges, these worthies, unlike the Italian witnesses to so many other vendetta murders, actually testified to what they had seen. Espare was quickly convicted of the crime, and when he was hanged for it in 1905, it allegedly marked the first time in the city's history that an Italian was executed for the murder of another Italian. But the conclusion to be drawn from this six-month back-and-forth killing spree was inescapable. As the newspapers put it, the city's Italian underworld was reawakening from its decade-long slumber. And the Luciano affair did indeed herald a marked increase in so-called mafia activity in New Orleans. In particular, the extortion gangs, known collectively as the Black Hand, began again to make their presence felt in the city. Crime historians today generally make a clear distinction between the Black Hand, essentially a blackmail technique that all but disappeared after the 1920s, and the Mafia, a much longer-lived syndicate of organized crime families, whose members often engaged in Black Hand activity. But to the general public of the early 1900s, they were essentially the same threat, perpetrated by the same population of immigrants. And when merchants in the Italian community began to receive anonymous extortion letters in the aftermath of the Luciano incident, the police and the newspapers had their suspicions about who was responsible. For many, the uptick in mafia activity followed too closely upon the arrival of Francesco Genova to be coincidence. A new capo had apparently come to New Orleans, and the lesson of the Orleans Parish prison lynching was one he'd never learned. Even so, the ire of the city's better element was not fully raised again until, as in the Hennessy case, one of its own was affected. This is what happened on that June evening of 1907. Peter LaManna, a prosperous and worthy stalwart of the Progressive Union, had had his beloved son stolen from the threshold of his own home. The lesson of 1891, it seemed, would have to be taught again. A crowd of 4,000 to 5,000 people packed the main auditorium of the Union Française Hall on the evening of Wednesday, June 12th. 4 days had passed since the disappearance of Walter LaManna, and no trace of the boy had yet been found. The night before, following the instructions of the Black Hand letter, Peter LaManna had ridden out on the road to Bogalusa with a sack containing $6,000 in gold. Contrary to those instructions, he'd been followed by a contingent of New Orleans police. But either the police had been detected or something else had gone wrong, because no kidnapper met the father to take his offered ransom. Now, the police were left with few concrete leads to work with. Wednesday night's mass meeting, called by the city's Progressive Union and several Italian leaders, was intended to produce some clues by urging members of the Italian community to abandon their customary silence on mafia matters. The LaManna kidnapping was the type of outrage that could not be allowed to stand. "The people of New Orleans are easygoing and overlook many things," the Daily Picayune observed, "but now and then malefactors, emboldened by immunity for years, strike a blow which threatens the very foundation of society or the home. Then they are given an exhibition of the power of a people aroused in their wrath." But that wrath had to be properly channeled, and so this meeting had been called. Speaker after speaker pleaded with the residents of the Italian quarter to come forward with information about the LaManna case, or about any other mafia-like activity they might know about. Judge Philip Paterno, one of the leaders of the community, announced the formation of an Italian vigilance committee to handle the problem of crime in the neighborhood. "From now on, the Italians will be resolved to act," he vowed. "Any Italian who henceforth receives a threatening letter will be compelled to lay it before the committee." Paterno's speech was met with enthusiastic cheering and applause, as were the similar declamations of many other speakers that night. But the greatest ovation, at least if the Daily Picayune is to be believed, was reserved for Colonel John C. Wycliffe, one of the leaders, with W.S. Parkerson, of the 1891 lynching. There were also loud calls for Parkerson, the paper noted, but Mr. Parkerson was not present. Wycliffe urged the crowd to cooperate with Judge Paterno. "There has been too much of a disposition on the part of Italian people to fight their own battles alone, and to fear asking aid," he said. "But they ought to be made to know that they are living in a land of liberty, and that they can get the support of every citizen. Is it possible that a handful of criminals can defy a city of 300,000 inhabitants? Is it possible that these men can remain undetected? On behalf of your own little ones, strive in every way possible to stop such an infamous business." After the meeting was adjourned, excited crowds poured out into the streets of the Vucere. Too impatient to wait for voluntary offers of information, one vigilante mob gathered near the site of the old parish prison, threatening to make more history for Congo Square, a not-so-veiled reference to the Italian lynchings of 1891. Others flooded into the streets around the LaManna residence. Defying police, they stormed through the surrounding neighborhood, pounding on doors and demanding to be admitted to search the premises. The terrified residents could do little but comply. True, the vigilantes were after blood, the Daily Picayune admitted the next day, but only the blood of the guilty. These intimidation tactics produced results. In one overcrowded rooming house, the vigilantes found two schoolboys who admitted having seen Walter LaManna walking on Saturday with a man named Tony Costa. Reinvigorated by this breakthrough, the mob proceeded immediately to Costa's home on the corner of St. Philip and Charters. They entered the premises and ransacked the house from top to bottom, and although they found no one fitting Costa's description, another resident of the house told them that Costa did indeed live there, that he was a notorious gambler and ex-con, and that he had been missing since Saturday. The police had in the meantime met with some investigative success of their own. Rumors that a strange Italian had recently purchased a covered wagon in the neighborhood proved to be accurate. Detectives following a lead out in Jefferson Parish, west of the city, turned up a witness who saw a covered wagon late on Saturday night pulling into the yard of a St. Rose plantation farm owned by one Ignazio Campisciano. This was another name, at least. Then, on Thursday morning, Peter LaManna received another unsigned letter. "With tears in my eyes, I send you these few lines for your comfort." The letter began in flowery Italian. "Therefore, be a man and accept my confidence. I do so for the love of your son." The letter writer went on to tell LaManna how to find the boy. "Go to Harvey Canal and call on a man named Macorio Morti. He knows all. When you get him, ask him about the barber who is living at Harvey Canal. The barber is the chief of all. I have no doubt that he has your son." Following up on these and several other leads, police had by Friday arrested 10 suspects, most notably Tony Costa, who had been found holed up in a house on Cluett Street. Also in custody were the farmer Campisciano, the Harvey Canal informant mentioned in the anonymous letter, the owner of the ice cream store near the LaManna home, and, at the special request of the Italian Vigilance Committee, Francesco Genova, the alleged capo who had been involved in the Luciano shootings 5 years earlier. Genova was by this time a wealthy businessman, allegedly feared by all Italians of New Orleans. What evidence, if any, the committee had of Genova's involvement in the case is unclear, but since he was the leading figure in what passed for the local mafia society, police seemed certain that he was in some way implicated. At this point, Captain Thomas Capo, the inconveniently named officer in charge of the investigation, had some justification for believing that he was making progress. But virtually all of the evidence on which these men were held was circumstantial. After the intervention of lawyers, police were forced to release all except Tony Costa, who nonetheless still protested his innocence in the most vehement terms possible. Even so, police were careful to keep the released suspects under constant surveillance and to keep pursuing tips and other leads, which were being brought to the Vigilance Committee in increasing numbers. By now, more than a week had passed since Walter LaManna disappeared, and hopes that the boy would be found alive were fading. Acting on persistent rumors that the boy had been killed and concealed in the bayou behind the Campisciano farm, police on June 21st hired a special train and transported a 25-man search party to the site. But the swamp in this area was one of the densest and most forbidding in Louisiana. Although the men searched with a team of bloodhounds for an entire day, often knee-deep in muck and tormented by mosquitoes, they found nothing. At dusk, the exhausted searchers emerged empty-handed from the swamp as the tight-lipped Campisciano, ostensibly working his land, looked on. As more and more days passed without any further progress in the case, tensions began to surface among the frustrated investigators. The police began accusing the Italian Vigilance Committee of meeting in secret and withholding important information. Peter LaManna, meanwhile, had all but cut off communication with the official investigators, choosing to follow his own lines of inquiry. Apparently, he felt that a heavy-handed police presence did more harm than good, interfering with the willingness of potential witnesses to tell what they knew. Finally, some 2 weeks after the disappearance, another key name emerged from the cacophony of innuendos and accusations. For days, Judge Paterno had been hearing from various Italian businessmen who had received extortion letters over the past weeks. But one of them actually claimed to know who wrote the letter he'd received. Taking the judge to the window of his own office, the merchant pointed to a man standing on the corner just outside. "That is the man who wrote it," the merchant said. Tony Gendusa. Judge Paterno did not act immediately on this revelation. It was, after all, only one of numerous accusations he was hearing every day. But when he eventually compared the merchant's note with the original letter sent to Peter LaManna, he noticed that the handwriting was suspiciously similar. And when he went to Tony Gendusa's home, he discovered that the man was now missing. Paterno sent some detectives out to Pecan Grove, a town near the Campisciano farm in St. Rose, where, according to Tony Gendusa's brother Frank, the missing man's sweetheart lived, but they found nothing. Paterno, however, kept digging, and he soon began to turn up some suggestive connections between Tony Gendusa and a few of the other suspects in the crime. Gendusa, he learned, had been seen with prime suspect Tony Costa several times in the weeks before the kidnapping, often accompanied by another man, Francisco Lucchesi. Now Lucchesi was also missing, and so apparently was another known associate named Leonardo Gabbia, who lived with his sister and parents in a house just a few doors away from the LaManna residence. According to neighborhood gossip, the Gabbias knew more about Walter LaManna's disappearance than they had revealed to the police. Mrs. Gabbia, Leonardo's mother, had allegedly visited Mrs. LaManna several times since the kidnapping, assuring her that little Walter was safe and encouraging the LaMannas to pay the ransom to get him back. At the time, her words had been dismissed as the well-meant reassurances of an aging neighbor, but now they were beginning to seem rather more sinister. Very early one morning, police staged a raid on the Gabbia home. Leonardo Gabbia was in the house, still in bed, and he was apprehended without incident, and his arrest proved to be the break that ultimately unraveled the entire conspiracy. Professing his own innocence in the plot, he nonetheless confessed to know all about it. He had seen Tony Costa leading the boy away from the undertaking parlor, he said. He'd seen Costa turn the boy over to a man named Stefano Monfre, who had been waiting at the corner of Bourbon and St. Philip with a covered wagon, driven by Francisco Lucchesi. Gabbia also confirmed that Tony Gendusa had written the Black Hand letter demanding $6,000. This was sufficient information for Judge Paterno to start making new arrests. He had the entire Gabbia family locked up, along with Tony Gendusa's brother Frank, Stefano Monfre's wife, and even the couple who, with the Gabbias, ran the rooming house on St. Philip. But the most important revelation came in the confession of Gabbia's sister, Nicolina, who verified what Paterno had long suspected, that the boy had been taken to the Campisciano farm in St. Rose. Ignazio Campisciano, of course, had been arrested and released some days earlier for lack of evidence. Now Paterno had the corroboration he needed to proceed more aggressively against the farmer. He arranged with the Illinois Central Railroad for a special train to St. Rose and assembled a posse to head out there that evening. Among the posse members was a trainmaster for the railroad named Frank T. Mooney, the same man who 10 years later would become superintendent of police. Mooney, apparently interested in police work even then, involved himself closely in the Campisciano arrest, and even provided the Daily Picayune with a sensational account of it. After the special train arrived at Pecan Grove at around midnight, Mooney explained, "We put out the headlight of the engine and all the lights in the coach, and then walked the tracks for 1.5 miles to Campisciano's houses. Paterno put a guard around both buildings, Campisciano's home and a shed about 50 yards away, where it was believed Walter LaManna might be held. Then they pounded on Campisciano's door until they had roused him from sleep. The farmer finally came to the door in his underclothes. Our party pushed the door open and stepped inside," Mooney told the Picayune. "Judge Paterno spoke out sharply, 'Give us the boy. We came for the child.' Campisciano stood without a word. 'Where is the LaManna boy?' demanded Judge Paterno, without a quiver. The Italian only shrugged his shoulders in the Roman style, pleading ignorance. He declared he knew nothing of the matter and stoutly maintained that position. But the party had come there determined. It was not to be put off as it had been once before. Campisciano was quickly seized and bound hand and foot. His hands were pinioned behind his back, and his legs were bound with ropes. He was carried outside, and a rope was quickly fastened around his neck." Intimidated by this somewhat less than legal interrogation technique, Campisciano relented and indicated that he would speak. The noose around his neck was loosened, and he proceeded to tell how Monfray, Lucchese, and two other men, one of whom he knew as Angelo in Carcaterra, had brought the boy to his house in a covered wagon. But when Paterno asked the farmer where the boy was now, the man turned stonily silent. Again the rope was tightened around his neck, and he was threatened with hanging from a nearby tree. Finally he gave in. When the rope was again loosened, Campistiano made the admission that everyone had feared. The boy is dead. He went on to relate every detail of the heinous crime. Mooney continued, "He took us over to the other house and showed us the very spot and the position the child was lying in when he was murdered, choked to death. He pleaded that he had nothing whatsoever to do with it and that the others had committed the deed." Judge Paterno demanded that Campistiano lead them to the boy's body. The farmer wanted to wait until morning, since the place was deep in the swamps behind his house and the moon had already set. But Paterno insisted, and so they set off, several men holding lanterns as they picked their way through the marshy wilderness. Campistiano begged his captors to untie his hands so he could at least push aside the reeds as he walked. Paterno agreed, but they kept a rope around his neck and another around his shoulders, each held by one of the posse to ensure that the farmer didn't slip away in the gloom. "You can imagine the situation," Mooney told the Picayune. "This Italian leading a party through the swamp, wading in water to their waists and through brush and briars. None of us felt sure that he had told us the truth, and who knew that this leader of the Black Hand was not leading us into a death trap?" But finally, several miles into the fetid swamp, Campistiano stopped and pointed to a spot under some willow branches. "There," he said. "And he told the truth," Mooney reported. "Upon lifting the heavy boughs, we saw this gray-colored bundle. It was resting on some wild cane reeds. The odor was terrible, and as the bundle was picked up and the blanket unwrapped, the head dropped from the shoulders." This last macabre detail of the boy's head detaching from the torso, apparently as a result of advanced decomposition, would be picked up and headlined in newspapers all around the country over the next few days. In New Orleans, it raised the level of mob hysteria to a new and feverish pitch. When the body was brought back to the city and laid out in the morgue, thousands of people assailed the building. The Daily Picayune described the scene. "The mob thronged the yard and jammed through the narrow door of the dead house. There, the insane desire to possess some gruesome souvenir of the most horrible crime to shock New Orleans since the Hennessy assassination took hold of the people, and they fought and fell over each other in an effort to tear off pieces of the clothes in which the body had been found, and which still lay, reeking with maggots and shreds of rotting flesh, on the slab." Meanwhile, other information was emerging from interrogations with the incarcerated suspects. According to Campistiano, Walter LaManna had actually been killed on the Wednesday following the kidnapping, meaning that the child had been dead for 10 days already. Apparently, the kidnappers had been frightened by news of the mob actions in New Orleans that evening and had decided to abort the kidnapping. So Angelo in Carcaterra, allegedly on the order of Leonardo Gabbia, the leader of the group, had seized the boy and unceremoniously strangled him to death. Then they had wrapped the body in a blanket and carried it out to a remote corner of the swamp, where they hoped it would never be found. The extent of the conspiracy involved in this ugly piece of business was difficult for officials to assess. Police had 6 of the principal suspects in custody: Campistiano and his wife, Tony Costa, Frank Gandusa, and Leonardo and Nicolina Gabbia. At least 4 were still at large, including Lucchese, the wagon driver, Tony Gandusa, the letter writer, Stefano Monfre, who owned the covered wagon, and Angelo in Carcaterra, who had actually strangled the boy. But there were several other conspirators mentioned in various bits of testimony who remained unaccounted for. A tall man named Joe, whom Campistiano had seen with Stefano Monfre on the morning after the kidnapping, a mysterious man with a pockmarked face who had come to Monfre's house several times before the kidnapping, and, perhaps most tellingly, a wronged man named Mr. Cristina. Could this have been Paolo Di Cristina, the associate of Capo Francisco Genova, who had been involved in the 1902 Luciano incident? Whatever the connections, it was clear that the kidnapping cabal was large and complex. that such an elaborate conspiracy could have flourished in the festering alleys of the Lower French Quarter, apparently known to so many residents, none of whom saw fit to report it to the police, was appalling. So much for the so-called lesson of the Hennessy lynching. Still, at least some members of the community had come forward with information, and so the Italian Vigilance Committee tried to put as good a face on the situation as they could. "The reign of the Black Hand is over in New Orleans," they told the Times-Democrat, though it was clearly a declaration more hopeful than justified. Police continued to pursue the missing suspects, even sending detectives to Kansas to check out a tip that Stefano Monfray might be hiding out with relatives there. But it soon became apparent that Monfray and the other absent conspirators were gone for good. The six suspects in custody, meanwhile, were indicted and sent to the prison in Hanville, the seat of St. Charles Parish, where the case would be tried since the murder had occurred in that parish. The trial of the first four defendants began at the courthouse in Hanville on July 15th. Nicolina and Leonardo Gabbia would be tried at a later date, but the Campistianos, Tony Costa, and Frank Gandusa would face a jury first. Autopsy results had indicated that Walter LaManna had been killed by a hatchet blow to the forehead. This had only increased the public's rage at the perpetrators, and the trial attracted huge, hostile crowds to the little county seat. Security was heavy, with scores of sheriff's deputies and other police on hand to keep order. The trial lasted 4 days. During their testimony, the defendants predictably professed their own innocence of any active role in the affair, casting themselves as merely frightened witnesses to acts perpetrated by the five men and one woman still at large or not yet on trial. But in this case, unlike in the Hennessy case 16 years earlier, the evidence against the accused was persuasive. The police work had been far more careful this time, and no one but the defense attorney seemed at all discomfited by the fact that Campistiano had been forced to confess with a rope around his neck. Even so, the jury, after deliberating for less than an hour, came back to the courtroom with a qualified verdict. "Guilty," the foreman announced, "but without capital punishment." The evidence, as one juror later explained, was simply not conclusive enough to justify hanging. It took three companies of the state militia, bayonets drawn, to prevent the enraged crowds outside the courtroom from administering their own form of justice, on the defendants and on the jurors. One confrontation nearly erupted into bloody violence when a train commandeered by an irate mob from New Orleans was turned back at gunpoint from the tiny Hanville station. Back in New Orleans, Mayor Martin Behrman was forced to order the closing of all saloons, hotel bars, and private clubs in the city, and to send a force of special police into the Italian Quarter to keep order and defend the LaManna's neighbors. These precautions proved effective. Despite the all-too-predictable mob cries of "We want the Dagos," the widespread violence that had characterized the Hennessy and Robert Charles affairs never materialized. Meanwhile, the Daily Item was almost wistful in its editorial regrets over what it, and virtually every other paper in New Orleans, considered a ridiculous outcome. A real verdict, a verdict with a capital punishment attachment in this LaManna case, would have gone far to make them, i.e. lower-class Sicilians, recognize that American law was a vital and mighty thing, a thing to fear. So much of good would surely have resulted from a legal execution in the premises. In the end, the people of New Orleans did get that legal execution. The trial of Leonardo and Nicolina Gabbia, much delayed because of the high feeling provoked by the earlier trial, ended with both brother and sister being found guilty and sentenced to hang. Nicolina's sentence was later commuted to life in prison. The prospect of executing a woman was still repugnant to many, no matter what the crime. But on Friday, July 16, 1909, Leonardo Gabbia was led to a scaffold in the Hanville prison yard and hanged by the neck until he was dead. Afterward, the noose was presented to Peter LaManna, who expressed his gratitude that at least one of the perpetrators had gotten his just deserts. Ultimately, something tangible did come out of the LaManna tragedy. The year after Gabbia's execution, the Louisiana state legislature passed a law mandating a death sentence for anyone convicted of kidnapping a child. It was, for some at least, a satisfying outcome. But any notion that the Black Hand had been routed for good in the Crescent City would eventually be dispelled, and much sooner than even the most pessimistic New Orleanian might have expected. Chapter 12, A Reawakening. The second wave of reform arrived in 1907 in the shape of a woman wielding an axe. A few days before Christmas, a Northeastern Railroad train from Mississippi pulled into New Orleans bearing one of the iconic reform figures of the age. Carrie Nation, the hatchet-swinging firebrand from Caird County, Kentucky, famous nationwide for her saloon-smashing campaign to stamp out demon rum and all its attendant vices, had come to the city as part of a speaking tour throughout the American South. Armed with a Bible and an ample supply of miniature gold-plated hatchets to distribute as souvenirs, she had planned out a full program of lectures and prayer meetings in some of the town's most notorious dens of iniquity. She knew that she'd face plenty of opposition, but Carrie Nation was determined to save the Crescent City's soul. Initially, the white-haired, lantern-jawed reformer had been reluctant to bring her message to the so-called Great Southern Babylon. "New Orleans is too tough a place for me to tackle," she'd told reporters in Birmingham in mid-December. "It is a very, very bad place, and I am getting too old." But somehow she had thought better of her decision. "I believe in being everlastingly on the warpath," she announced a few days later, explaining her change of heart. "We must fight the devil, and there are real devils." Nowhere was that truer, apparently, than in New Orleans, and so she had come after all. Trailing an entourage of newsmen, admirers, and gawkers, Nation went straight from the train station to City Hall to meet with Mayor Martin Behrman. His Honor the Mayor, no slouch himself when it came to deviltry, seemed somewhat amused by the compact but passionate old woman who appeared at his office door in her trademark widow's weeds. Speaking before reporters, Behrman welcomed her to the city but insisted that she refrain from any saloon smashing while she was there. But Nation could make no promises. "I am nothing but a lump of mud in the hands of God," she said. "Would the mayor be so audacious as to refuse the Lord his right to smash?" Behrman thought about this for a moment before responding that he would not attempt to prevent the Lord, but he certainly would have his officers prevent her. Thus, they parted on good, if somewhat uneasy, terms, with a promise to meet again before she left town. Over the next 3 days, Mrs. Nation made a thorough tour of the city's hotels, taverns, and barrel houses, preaching her message of temperance to all who would listen. The time had come, she insisted, for the total prohibition of alcohol, not just in New Orleans, but in the nation at large. "President Theodore Roosevelt is a bag of wind," she told one crowd at the St. Charles Hotel. "Roosevelt, Bush, Schlitz, Pabst, and Muirline are the quintet which is doing America much harm. The first is a beer-guzzling Dutchman, and the others are making it, the beer, for him and his loyal subjects. The country should be ashamed of the people ruling it." But alcohol was only one of the targets of Mrs. Nation's wrath. Gambling, smoking, foul language, sexual impurity, and of course prostitution were also on her prohibition agenda, so she made sure to investigate Storyville itself. She first accepted an invitation from Emma Johnson to visit the House of All Nations, perhaps the most flagrantly depraved of all the Storyville brothels. Invited into the parlor with the madam and her charges, the fiery orator ended up doing more listening than preaching. One by one, the women of the place explained to her how they had come to prostitution not as a result of coercion or entrapment by an evil seducer, the tendentious white slavery explanation put forth by many reformers of the day, but rather by their own free will, forced to fend for themselves in a world where female workers made pennies a day in so-called legitimate jobs, they had instead chosen their current profession. All who spoke to Mrs. Nation, in fact, professed to be content with their lives and saw very little wrong in them. Madam Johnson herself even claimed that she prayed regularly and fully expected to end up in heaven. This last may have been the most shocking thing Mrs. Nation heard in Storyville on that Saturday night. But she found a more suitably repentant audience at her second stop in the district, at Josie Arlington's palace on Basin Street. Here the ladies of the house listened respectfully as Nation roundly rebuked them and urged them to repent their ways, falling onto her knees at one point to pray for their salvation. Josie Arlington, whose thoughts of late had been turning in precisely this direction, proved to be a particularly receptive auditor. With some emotion, the Queen of the Demimonde promised the great reformer that she would heed the call to return to a more respectable way of life. Josie claimed that she would retire soon and use her fortune, now totaling some $60,000, as she pointedly confided, to build a home for fallen women, so that they would not have to turn to prostitution to survive. She would do this, Josie said, just as soon as I get a little richer. Perhaps frustrated by the conspicuous lack of any instant converts to her cause in Storyville, Nation arrived at her last stop of the night, Tom Anderson's annex, with her usual pugnacity, and her axe, apparently, on full display. According to one story, Anderson had heard beforehand that she was on her way, and so had cleared the long bar of all but the cheapest whiskey. When Nation and her entourage entered the annex, Anderson was there to greet her, dressed in his finest evening clothes. "Welcome, Mrs. Nation," he said, giving her a deferential bow. "I've been expecting you." She was not impressed. After snatching a cigarette from the mouth of one of the customers hovering around her, she allegedly walked over to the bar with her axe and smashed several of the whiskey glasses standing on it. Then she turned to Anderson and said, "Want to make something of it?" Unruffled as always, Anderson bowed again. "Mrs. Nation," he oozed, "the pleasure is all mine." It was to be her toughest audience of the night. Provided with a crate to stand on, Nation addressed the crowd of men in the bar, urging them to shun the saloons, the gambling houses, and the brothels, and instead to be men. Numerous times she was interrupted by drunken hecklers, but she was undeterred. She talked, in fact, for almost a full hour, until manager Billy Struve, concerned about the Sunday closing law, forcefully brought the proceedings to a close at a few minutes before 12. By the stroke of midnight, Nation and her audience were all out on the banquet in front of the annex. She then rode home from her evening of slumming in Storyville, according to the Daily Picayune, none the worse for her lively experience. By the time Mrs. Nation left the city the next day, however, she was looking noticeably pale and worn out. After giving a lecture to an audience of 800 at the local YMCA, a lecture that reportedly included such lurid descriptions of the goings-on in Storyville that even the Picayune was scandalized on behalf of the women present, she returned to City Hall to pay her respects to the mayor. At their meeting, she asked Behrman to promise that he would stamp out the horrible practices she had witnessed in the district. The mayor's response is unrecorded, but most likely he demurred. And with that, Carrie Nation moved on. She was, by her own admission, old and tired now, and maybe New Orleans really was too tough a place for her. That evening, after 3 days in the belly of the beast, she quietly boarded a ship bound for Florida, where, one can presume, the resident sinners weren't quite so recalcitrant. To say that Carrie Nation's visit in late 1907 galvanized the city's slumbering moral reformers would perhaps be an exaggeration, but her appearance did coincide with the beginning of renewed efforts to take control of New Orleans' persistent sin problem, and to do so in a rather less accommodative way. Tolerance and segregation of vice had been tried, and this is what had resulted: rich madams, contented whores, booming business in saloons and gambling halls, and a nightly tableau of debauchery in the district that was all too reminiscent of a painting by Bruegel the Younger. The sheer complacency and matter-of-factness of sin in the Crescent City, captured vividly in a series of Storyville portraits executed around this time by a white Creole photographer named E.J. Belloc, indicated to many that a different approach was needed, and that the whole idea of Storyville had outlived its usefulness. In any case, Victorian attitudes toward prostitution were changing. No longer was it viewed as a distasteful but necessary safeguard for respectable women, as a safety valve of sorts for the release of male sexual energy. With the rise of the social hygiene and other progressive era movements, prostitution was increasingly being seen as a threat, a conduit by which ills like syphilis and gonorrhea could invade the sanctity of the home. As such, it was not enough just to tuck it away in its own district. Rather, it had to be stamped out entirely. And, as Carrie Nation's sermons had made clear, the new spirit of prohibition was nothing if not comprehensive, targeting not just prostitution and alcohol, but gambling, dancing, tobacco use, and, in New Orleans at least, the lingering affront to decency of interracial fraternization, represented most visibly by the so-called octoroon houses of Basin Street. One big new problem with Storyville, in the reformers' eyes, was that the supposedly isolated vice district was no longer so isolated. On June 1, 1908, a new Union Railroad terminal opened for business right at the intersection of Basin Street and Canal. This new Frisco Depot, designed by Chicago architect Daniel Burnham, was a gorgeous neoclassical pile with high ceilings and sweeping architectural lines that would have been a credit to any city. But the terminal's location forced arriving trains to come directly down the middle of Basin Street, passing every one of that street's luxury brothels on the way. Within weeks of the station's opening, reports were already flooding in of naked prostitutes waving to passengers from brothel windows, of so-called lighthouses, usually young boys, waiting in the terminal to lead willing male arrivals to the nearby district, and even of unsuspecting young women wandering off into the streets of Storyville in search of their hotels. For those trying to improve the city's reputation as a serious center for business and commerce, the situation was a disaster. First to respond to this new embarrassment was the Travelers Aid Society, a women's organization founded by New Orleans reformist ERA Club to prevent young girls from being recruited by the city's brothels. By August of 1908, they were already agitating to move the Basin Street houses from their current location and convert the buildings to workers' housing. "We have no doubt that every person and organization of good moral and civic principles in the city will join us in what we have undertaken," the society's spokesperson, Mary Werlein, told reporters. The restricted district was already unfortunately located on almost every ground imaginable, but now that several railroads are emptying thousands of new people at its very doors, it seems to us that we cannot properly allow such an entry into our city to be maintained. First impressions are the strongest, and we can imagine no more undesirable first impression of New Orleans than this. But the true leader of this new offensive against Storyville was Mary Werlein's nephew, Philip, scion of the venerable Werlein family that had been doing business in New Orleans since 1853. The Werlein Music Store on Canal Street, founded by Philip's grandfather, a Bavarian pianist and composer, had been the local bastion of traditional music for decades. True, the store was the source of many of the instruments played by the city's jazzmen. It's where Kid Ory bought the trombone that led to his 1905 encounter with Buddy Bolden. But the company was proudest of its distinction as the original publisher of the classic Southern anthem, Dixie. Like Joseph Shakespeare, W.S. Parkerson, Sidney Story, and many of the other reform leaders who preceded him, Philip Werlein was a blue blood through and through. President of the Pickwick, Boston, and New Orleans country clubs, director of the Interstate Bank, sponsor of the French Opera House, and now president of the New Orleans Progressive Union, he was the perfect embodiment of the wealthy white establishment that had been actively trying to reform the city for two decades now. In 1909, Werlein and the Progressive Union proposed an alternative solution to the problem of the Basin Street Depot. Instead of moving the street's brothels, as his aunt suggested, Werlein proposed to erect a wooden screen that would essentially put a wall between the depot and the Storyville side of Basin Street. This proposal, silly as it sounds, actually got as far as the city council, but the aldermen ended up defeating it soundly, seeing it as entirely impracticable. Undeterred, both Werleins vowed to fight on. Other reform efforts on the state level were making better progress. In 1908, the Louisiana legislature passed the so-called Gay Shattuck Bill. Pushed through mainly by conservative elements in the northern parishes of the state, the measure was a comprehensive law that attacked the vice problem on virtually every front, addressing the issues of wine, women, and song. Besides dramatically raising the license fees for selling alcohol statewide, it banned women from patronizing or working in any place where liquor was sold. The law also prohibited the serving of blacks and whites in the same establishment and made musical performances illegal in all saloons. The only exception to these rules was one made for restaurants and hotels where meals were served. But for the vast majority of businesses in Storyville, the law's implications were dire. No more jazz combos at the Arlington Annex, which had no kitchen. No more champagne at Lulu White's Mahogany Hall. No more interracial fraternization at the dance halls on Franklin Street if alcohol was being served. In fact, the Daily Item predicted that fully one half of the barrooms in New Orleans would be forced into bankruptcy once the law took effect in early 1909. And indeed, Gay Shattuck did put the lid down in the tenderloin, as the newspapers like to say, at least at first. In January, when the new rules were implemented, the Daily Picayune noted with satisfaction that the saloon men and dive keepers raised a howl which vibrated from one end of the district to the other. The old familiar blast of the trombone and cornet, and the accompanying shriek of the clarionet, sic, were not among the attractions to lure the slummer into the saloons and dance halls. But the denizens of Storyville were nothing if not resourceful. Noting the exception in the law for places serving meals, the establishments of the district were soon styling themselves as restaurants. One saloon set up a makeshift tamale stand next to its front door, while many another club owner or saloon keeper unearthed some antique sandwich that could be passed around the room indefinitely as proof of the establishment's culinary bona fides. Exploitation of this loophole, combined with a general lack of enforcement by Mayor Behrman's eminently persuadable police force, meant that it was soon business as usual for most places in the district, at least while no one in authority was watching. For the mayor of Storyville, now in his early 50s and graying into an ever more distinguished-looking middle age, the depredations of the city's reformers were still taking a relatively minor toll on the operations of his empire of sin. The first decade of the district's existence had proved lucrative indeed for him, and Tom Anderson now found himself a very rich man. Growing profits from his various tenderloin businesses were only part of the bounty. His legitimate oil interests had also thrived, allowing him to sell his old Record Oil Company and start a new enterprise, Liberty Oil, that promised to be an even greater success. Vice and hydrocarbons had proved to be the twin engines of New Orleans' prosperity, and Tom Anderson had a hand in both. But there were indications that Anderson's charmed life might be entering a more difficult phase. It had begun with a personal tragedy. Sometime in mid-1907, Olive Anderson had become sick. The exact nature of her illness remains unclear, but she probably developed some form of cancer. She underwent two surgeries that fall, and although her doctors were at first optimistic, complications had set in. By December, it was clear that she would not survive. Tom would later claim that he and Ollie had married in June of 1898, which seems unlikely given that his divorce from Catherine Turnbull did not become official until the following year, but they had another ceremony performed at her deathbed in the Hotel Dieu Hospital. Ollie, the former prostitute, had recently converted to Catholicism and wanted a priest to officiate. But since the church did not recognize Anderson's divorce from his second wife, this proved impossible. And so a judge had done the deed, in Ollie's hospital room with a nurse as witness, a few days before Christmas. Ollie died on December 26th. 2 days later, the funeral was held at the home of Tom's daughter Irene, now Mrs. George Delsa, attending were some of the Andersons' closest friends, including Mayor Behrman, former police chief John Journey, Billy Struve, W.J. O'Connor, the man who had been with David Hennessy on the night of his assassination, and, of course, Josie Arlington, a.k.a. Mrs. Tom Brady. His wife's death seemed to change Tom Anderson's luck. It was just a few months later that reformers began their assault on sin in the Crescent City, and much of the onslaught seemed to be targeted primarily at the mayor of Storyville himself. In March of 1908, the Reverends E.L. Collins and S.A. Smith, superintendents of the Kentucky and Louisiana Anti-Saloon Leagues, came to New Orleans to carry out an investigation of conditions in Storyville. What they found was, predictably, shocking. If an absolutely truthful man had sworn on the witness stand that things were as bad as they are, I would never have believed them, Reverend Collins told the press. For shame to flaunt itself so openly and brazenly right on the streets is something that I have never seen in my life. Dr. Smith, however, offered some hope. Tom Anderson and such cattle, he said, want everything stopped but dirtiness and evil. But public opinion is rising against them, bless your hearts, and their course will be stayed. Largely in response to appeals like this, the Gay Shattuck Law was passed shortly thereafter. But since Anderson and the other proprietors of the district proved so adept at getting around its provisions, the most effective attacks on Anderson County came via Tom's old nemesis, the Sunday Closing Law. Anderson had already been inconvenienced several times on this issue, but in the renewed spirit of reform heralded by Gay Shattuck, the attempts at Sabbath day entrapment became more frequent. One case against Anderson in September of 1909 actually came to trial. The charges were eventually dropped, however, when it was discovered that the two arresting officers, intentionally or otherwise, had failed to secure any evidence of the violation. But Anderson soon found a more formidable foe in the person of Reverend J. Benjamin Lawrence, pastor of the First Baptist Church. Lawrence, a leader of the city's temperance movement, began conducting his own undercover investigation of the city's demimonde in June of 1910. He, along with a young man named Alvin Callender and a third man, entered the Arlington restaurant on a Sunday. Lawrence ordered a bottle of whiskey, Callender ordered a beer, and the third man requested a pack of cigarettes. All were served, and this time the evidence was retained and turned over to the police waiting outside. Tom Anderson and his bartender were promptly arrested and charged with 3 counts of violating the Sunday closing law and 1 count of selling alcohol to a minor, since Callender turned out to be just 17 years old. The case, which took months to work its way through the courts, created a furor in the city far out of proportion to the relatively minor transgressions that had generated it. Reformers were determined to punish Tom Anderson, while the mayor of Storyville himself, backed by powerful wholesale alcohol interests, was equally determined to make the case go away. And so, Anderson's lawyers made prosecution of the case as difficult for officials as possible. At first, no judge or prosecutor, for reasons known only to themselves, seemed willing to try the case at all. After repeated continuances, the matter was finally brought to court, only to be thrown out on a technicality. No proof could be obtained that Tom Anderson even owned the Arlington restaurant on Rampart Street, despite the fact, pointed out by the exasperated Daily Item, that a large sign outside the establishment had prominently displayed his name as proprietor for more than 15 years. When the district attorney ordered a new trial, the proceedings were again delayed when the new affidavits drawn up for trial proved defective, lacking a valid address for the saloon in which the infractions had allegedly taken place. Outraged, the Item insisted that this nonsense be stopped and that the case be resolved. No good excuse can be offered for permitting this case to lie in the files until the witnesses die or move to Montana, the paper fulminated in an editorial. The defendant may need a vacation, the weather may be uncomfortably warm, or the barroom cat may have the mumps, but the case of the state of Louisiana against Thomas C. Anderson should be prosecuted promptly. Ultimately, the unstoppable force and the immovable object came to terms. Anderson agreed to plead guilty to 1 count of selling whiskey on a Sunday if the other charges were dropped. The prosecution agreed, and so Tom Anderson paid a $25 fine, plus another $50 for selling to a minor, a matter resolved separately in juvenile court. Reverend Lawrence, of course, claimed victory. But Tom Anderson knew better. The $75 was just a minor cost of doing business, and although he and his backers had probably paid far more than that in legal fees, their point had been made. You could fight the mayor of Storyville and perhaps even win a round or two, but the price would be exceedingly high. And so the vice mills of Storyville rolled on more or less unchecked. Lulu White, Emma Johnson, and Willie Piazza continued to do business on Basin Street, within plain sight of the passengers arriving at the Frisco Depot. In the dives and dance halls of Franklin Street, Freddie Keppard, Big Eye Louie Nelson, and the young wunderkind Sidney Bechet continued to play their new music to mixed audiences, provided there was an old ham sandwich on the premises. But for one Storyville icon, life had changed. A few years after her evening with Carrie Nation, Josie Arlington had retired and left the profession as promised. She leased the Basin Street brothel to her former housekeeper, Anna Casey, but retained ownership, thereby ensuring an ample revenue stream to support the family's luxurious new life on Esplanade Avenue. And though her plans to build a home for wayward girls were apparently on hold, and would in fact never come to fruition, she was now at least free of the taint of Basin Street in all ways but financial, She and her beloved niece Anna could spend all of their time together now, shopping, gardening, making excursions to Anna's villa in Covington, and generally living the life of just the kind of respectable upper-class family that Anna still believed she belonged to. For the woman now known to the world as Mrs. John Thomas Brady, this transformation must have come with overtones of revenge. Her yearnings for respectability had always seemed shaded by a certain contempt for those born into the condition naturally, and this contempt had erupted memorably on at least one occasion late in her career. According to hoary Storyville legend, the Queen of the Demimonde had by 1906 come to resent the daring young persons of socially prominent families who would show up incognito at Tom Anderson's annual Mardi Gras fete, the ball of the two well-known gentlemen. Masked in carnival regalia, these slumming voyeurs would gape condescendingly at the colorful revels of fallen women and their sporting men, all while remaining safely anonymous behind their masks. Josie Arlington solved the problem, one Storyville chronicler explained, by arranging for the police to raid the affair and to arrest any woman who did not carry a card registering her as a prostitute in good standing. The stratagem caused great embarrassment to the large number of ladies of New Orleans high society who were summarily carted off to the police station, unmasked, and sent home. But now, in 1909, Arlington had an even sweeter revenge. Those society ladies who enjoyed masquerading as prostitutes for a night would now have to tolerate a prostitute masquerading as a society lady for the rest of her life.